Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm your host, David Latulli. On this week's program, I'll be talking with composer Nolan Gasser and librettist Carrie Harrison about their new family opera, The Secret Garden, based on the classic work of children's lit by Frances Hodgson Burnett. The Cutting Ball Theatre's Annie Elias shares her directorial vision for their production of Ionesco's The Chairs, and a preview of some of the music that will be heard on this year's Other Minds Festival with recorder virtuosa Mikaela Petri and composer Sunleif Rasmussen. Later in the broadcast, just when you thought you had seen it all with Downton Abbey, now comes Parade's End, a six-part series on HBO based on Ford Madox Ford's classic with a script by Tom Stoppard. Who was Ford Madox Ford, you ask? Well, Peter Robinson will be on hand to guide your path through this little-known and long-forgotten Edwardian charmer. Stay with us. I'm talking now with Annie Elias, who is returning to the director's chair at the Cutting Ball Theater for a production of Eugene Ionesco's The Chairs. An award-winning playwright herself, she has written and directed numerous plays for Phantom Theater as well as other companies, and brings a background in physical theater and improvisation from her work with Chicago's celebrated Commedia-based company New Crime Productions. With a degree from Mills College and dramaturgical study at Harvard, she is currently chair of the Performing Arts Department at Marin Academy. Annie, welcome back to KLW.
Thank you so much.
Ionesco is considered a writer in the theater of the absurd. Now, for those listening who might need a refresher course, or perhaps who have never been exposed to Ionesco or Samuel Beckett, for that matter, could you share with us what that means?
Well, I think Ionesco, he's really responding to the imagination and the unconscious. So he's writing in what might not be a sort of psychological or logical way. He's really writing in a way that the logic is sort of a dream logic, where images are coming to him, and you know, from our point of view in the audience, they may not be have a sort of logical narrative particularly, but he's exploring sort of things like the imagination and absence and the incoherence of language, the inability of language to express. So he's sort of an existentialist. You know, his plays are, for example, The Chairs is set in a sort of apocalyptic landscape similar to Samuel Beckett. So if you think of Samuel Beckett, think of Ionesco, they're you know, connected. They're very similar in a lot of ways.
Now, my first exposure to Ionesco on stage was the 1998 New York production, which was a collaboration between Théâtre des Complicités and the Royal Court Theatre, directed by Simon McBurney, and it really still sticks in my mind. Now, could you share with us the synopsis of The Chairs?
Sure. Without giving away too much, because as you know, having seen that really celebrated, I'm very jealous that you saw that celebrated production. I don't want to give away too much because there are some surprises in it. But basically the story is that we see it's an exploration of the relationship between two old people. They're very old. The old man is 95. The old woman is 94. And they're extremely isolated. They're living in this kind of strange lighthouse, some kind of building where they're surrounded by water. It seems like the world has ended around them, and they're really reduced. They have sort of nothing left. It's sort of this feeling like all of their friends have died. And so one of the first things that's said is, hey, let's pretend. Let's pretend like we did the other night. Let's play a game, a pretend game, sort of like children who just start role-playing and using their imagination. They have nothing left except their imagination, really. Even their memories are depleted. So they start this game, and it seems that they have a kind of constructed, this game playing is part of their relationship. And they start playing this game where they're going to invite a lot of people over, and they're going to have these visitors. And we start, it starts rolling this kind of antic, what turns into a sort of antic frenzy of bringing a lot of chairs onto stage to support the huge crowd of people that are entering the room. The people are imagined. I think I can say that without...
I think you're safe there.
I think I'm safe. There are other surprises, but the people are part of their imagination, so...
That New York production I mentioned stands out especially for its physicality. It's such a physical... what they're doing on stage is amazing. Now, what are you bringing from your experience in Chicago, or how are you making this this intimate play, really, more of a physical experience?
Well, I read that Ionesco said, don't look to high literature for my sources of inspiration. My sources are the circus and Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton and Laurel and Hardy.
These are from his words.
Those are his words,
yeah.
Yes. So it was interesting that when I read the play, I saw that there was this sort of Buster Keaton-ish physical bit in it. And I think that's really evident in the text, that there's this kind of antic, Charlie Chaplin, Buster Keaton-esque physical craziness going on, antic kind of humor. There's a whole Harpo Marx kind of moment.
Uh-huh.
So we actually looked at a Buster Keaton bit and sort of worked it in. And the assistant director, Rem Myers, brought in a bit from Marx Brothers. And we actually used some material that those comedians had created. We actually inserted them into the play. And it seemed like, I mean, that's a huge part of the play. At the same time, it's very interesting because Ionesco calls it a tragic farce. So while there are these farcical elements in this whole physical comedy and physical, you know, again, think Charlie Chaplin or Buster Keaton, these antics, there's also this really deep layer of the tragic isolation that old people feel and the feeling of sort of meaninglessness and sorrow coming to the end of your life and a sort of contemplation of what has my life meant and what am I leaving behind.
Cutting Balls previously produced Ionesco's The Bald Soprano and Victims of Duty, but this is the first production of The Chairs, and it's in a new translation by Cutting Balls artistic director Rob Melrose. Now, what is Rob bringing out that may be different from other versions that you're familiar with?
Well, I think, you know, Rob's really versed in French, and he right away said, you know, these other translations, while good, have missed some of the language play that's going on, the puns and the play on words, and Ionesco loves to play with words. So I think Rob's translation has really brought that out. He's really translated that word play.
The production is, for the most part, a two-person production. I won't give away too much more there. It's David Sineko, Tamar Cohn, and Derek Fisher. Could you tell us about the core of actors you've assembled?
Well, it's a wonderful trio. A lot of the work has been with David and Tamar as the old woman, old man, and now we're working Derek into it. We, you know, a lot of the text is this couple playing, so we've done a lot of playing, game playing, theater games, and improvisational exercises as part of our rehearsal.
Extracurricular, so to speak, or extra-textural.
Yes, uh-huh. Exactly. For example, there's a moment in the play where the old woman opens a present, and there's a Keith Johnstone game of the actor, an acting exercise where you open a present and you explore what that object is. So I was able to just insert that that game directly into the play.
So the process that you're creating is based in some very solid technical aspects of putting on a show.
Yeah, and the actors, you know, we've employed some aspects of the theater company, New Crime Productions. Both David and I were in that company in Chicago, and it's a very stylized way of acting. It's based on Commedia dell'arte, and there are very specific, kind of precise ways of moving in this style. And so we've integrated some of that into the production. And I have to say that Tamar Cohn, having just sort of jumped into this, she is just fantastic. She picked it up really quickly. She's really a stellar physical actor, extremely precise.
Now, working with such a contemporary classic as The Chairs, did the actors maybe bring some preconceived notions, nevertheless, that you had to either shape or transform in some way?
I think one of the really complicated and challenging aspects for the actors has been playing the age and, you know, how to do that with integrity. You know, they're supposed to be 95 and 94, so how do you physicalize that? At the same time, they're, as I said, performing all these physical feats that would be impossible for a 94-year-old to do. So how to maintain the reality of their age at the same time as doing these impossible physical tasks, that's been really exciting and challenging, and how to find the balance of the age, the realism of the age somehow versus the larger than life or exaggerated aspect of the physical aspect of the play.
Ionesco's The Chairs, directed by my guest Annie Elias, runs through the entire month of March at the Exit Theater, the Cutting Balls Theater in Residence at Exit on Taylor Street through March 31st. Great seats are still available, and you can learn more by visiting cuttingball.com. Annie, I wish you a spectacular production.
Thank you so much.
That's music performed by Mikola Petri with friends from the Cremerata Baltica from a special birthday celebration CD, an excerpt from Vivaldi's Concerto in C. She and composer Sunleif Rasmussen join me now in studio. They're participating in this weekend's Other Minds Festival 18, a celebration of contemporary music and the all-important collaborative process in creating new works of musical art. Mikola is one of the world's most sought-after recorder players and continues to perform and carry the traditional recorder sound to the concert hall and recording studio. She just returned from New York, where she recorded the Telemann Sonatas with the great Anthony Newman on harpsichord. But she's also been an inspiration to contemporary composers to use the recorder in new and interesting ways. Composer Sunleif Rasmussen was born on Sandoy, the southernmost of the very northern and extraordinarily beautiful Faro Archipelago, whose islandscape and folk music has informed his writing of orchestral works, chamber music, solo pieces, electroacoustic works, and for tape as well as live electronics, and some great deal of choral music. I welcome you both to KLW Studios.
Thank you very much.
I must start with an apology, as the more I'm learning about the both of you, the more I wish I had more time to spend with you to share your wonderful work. So we'll consider this an all-too-brief overview today, and before we even start, I'll invite you back. Do you accept the invitation?
That would be wonderful. We're looking forward to it already.
All right, glad to hear it. I should also mention that you will have more quality time on this very radio station tomorrow evening at 11 on our regular broadcast of Music from Other Minds, which is highlighting music from this year's festival participants. I think, Mikola, you'll have some music there tomorrow night. Now, Mikola, as a flutist myself, I remember my first musical experience in grade school was playing the recorder in class. with about 20 other kids, these unison tunes, yeah. A sound that would probably be very painful to hear again, but nonetheless sowed the seeds for music in me that would be so fundamental to my life. I'm wondering how you first came to the recorder.
I came to the recorder before I can remember. I was less than 3 years old. My father, who is a violinist, he was on tour with his orchestra and brought back a recorder, which he saw in a window. And he went and bought it and brought it back to me. And I was sitting at my mother's lap, playing in the beginning, and I was just blowing in the recorder. She was putting the fingers the right places, and soon she discovered that I was blowing exactly the right rhythm. Then I got a music teacher, and then already at the late age 11, I started studying seriously along with much older students. So my whole education came very early in my life, and I never considered doing anything else than being a musician and playing the recorder. I think because I started so early, it feels so familiar to me, and I feel so easy expressing what I want musically on that instrument that I've stayed with it for that reason. Another reason is that it is a very natural instrument. It's even more natural than other wind instruments because it's just a piece of wood where you blow through a channel and then the air is split on this sharp edge
right,
below
the
channel.
Basics haven't changed for centuries. It's a vertically held instrument tube with holes in it. That
yes.
No reed involved at all.
That's right. And now, it's very close to the body because when you blow in the instrument, you have no embouchure to adjust the air with. So the way you blow in the instrument, you hear immediately back,
well,
more than on other wind instruments.
When I say you play the recorder, I should say recorders, as you have
yes.
quite an array of instruments. You can't
That's
really
right.
see them on the radio, but I'd love to hear some of these sampled instruments.
Yeah,
they
well,
come
in the
from
Baroque
the very,
time,
very large to the very small. Well, you're holding one of the bass instruments at the moment. How it's about, I'd say, close to a meter long.
Maybe, yes. Yeah, it's actually what you call a tenor recorder, and it's one of the big recorder families which you had in the Renaissance and Baroque time, where you had whole orchestras performing, consisting only of recorders. The tenor sounds like this. And then there's a smaller one, which is called the alto recorder, which is more common for Baroque music.
And I see there's a couple of keys on that one.
Yeah, that's not completely authentic
okay.
or natural. It's because it is a modern version, which I'm using for the Other Minds Festival and contemporary music. But in principle, it's the same instrument. The keys are only because I can't reach that far with my fingers. Then there's a soprano recorder, which is probably what you had when you went to school.
Exactly it.
And then there's a tiny sopranino.
Now this is less than a foot long for our listeners that are... Almost the piccolo range.
No, it's actually higher.
Higher than piccolo.
It starts... four notes above the piccolo and goes up two octaves. And then there is one even smaller recorder, which is very uncommon, but it does exist. And then there are bigger recorders, there are bass and great bass and sub-great bass recorders.
Wow.
But I don't play them so often because they are very soft in the sound, so they cannot be heard in a larger concert hall, for example.
We mentioned that the basics of the instrument have not changed, but you are a great contributor to contemporary techniques on the recorder and have encouraged composers to write works for a contemporary recorder, or at least contemporary sounds. What are some different sounds you can make that are not your Telemann-sounding recorder?
Yeah, that's right. The most challenging thing in contemporary music is that you often have to have much more expression. You need to make much larger differences between soft and loud, for example. But then there are also the direct effects you can make, like you can do multiphonics, which means more notes at the same time, of course. You can't play more tunes at the same time, but you can, by overblowing a low note, you can get one more note. I'll start blowing very softly. And loud, the same fingering would sound like this. And if you hit the middle between those two things, you can have both notes at the same time. Then there's, of course, a very traditional technique also of flutter tonguing, which means you let the tip of the tongue flutter in the airstream. This is used on all wind instruments, and on a recorder it would sound like this. And then there's the technique of glissando, which you can do easily on a string instrument by pulling your finger along the string as you are using the bow at the same time. On wind instruments with holes, you can pull off the fingers gradually, and that way make a glissando. Instead of lifting the fingers one by one, you pull off gradually.
Brilliant.
And you can sing and play at the same time. That's also often used. Either you sing and play the same tune, which gives a slightly different sound. Or you sing one tune and play another.
It's just marvelous. It's beautiful.
Well, it's fun.
Yeah. So as someone who's been an exponent of the recorder, you've had great success in encouraging composers to write for you. Now, is it sometimes difficult to get them on board to write for the recorder because they have in their head this traditional Baroque sound?
Well, most of the composers I've asked have been very open and have at least wanted to know what the recorder was before they said no. And then I've sat together with them, and I think composers very often think in the way like a musician. You know, I like challenges in music, and I like learning something new. I think also a composer, he would see the recorder as the instrument he had to write for now and make the best out of that instrument. I think that's the principle of composing. So actually very few composers have rejected to write a piece when I have asked them.
Well, speaking of composers that are writing for you, I'm talking with Mikaela Petri, who's part of the Other Minds Festival, as is my guest Sunleif Rasmussen. I mentioned in my introduction that Sunleif is from the Danish Faroe Islands. Now, for those listeners who may be geographically challenged, visualize east of Iceland, north of Scotland, and a long way from Mother Denmark. Now, not being familiar with the Faroes myself, I want to thank my KLW colleague and another Dane, Annette Bistrup, who works here, for a quick geography lesson this morning. And some of the images I Googled up on about the Faroe Islands today were just stunning. So I'm sure that has informed your vocabulary to a great extent. Sunleif, welcome once again to KLW.
Thank you very much.
Now, I should mention also that the folk music informs your writing, as does the Faroe's physical landscape. How so?
I mean, being on that island, you can't be aware of the weather. It's always present. Sometimes it's very beautiful, other times it's horrible. So the nature is very much at stake. And we have a very long tradition of folk music, or singing, actually. We don't have any folk instrument on the island. We use our feet to dance, a very easy dance, two steps to the left, one to the right, and then it goes like it's called a chain dance. And the poems are storytelling. It's about old king slaughtering a lot of people.
I'm wondering if there's a Scottish influence, because, or you're not supposed to mention the Scots. Is there an ancient rivalry that, oh, don't mention the Scots? You mentioned the Norwegians. You shouldn't mention the Norwegians. But is there influence from other cultures they're so isolated, it stays itself?
The Faroese folk music has been folk music throughout the entire Europe 1,200 years ago. But the island has been so isolated, so it has remained on the island, this particular type of... We have, for example, the whole Nibelungen Ringen, you know, these operas by Wagner. We have the whole text in Faroese language.
Wow.
You mean you have them as folk tales?
As folk tales.
Exactly the same story.
We sing them. Mm. Yeah. Siegfried Chant, and you know, yeah.
Well, let's hear a little bit from your violin concerto. We have a little bit of the folk influence going on in that. This is the violin concerto of my guest, Sunleif Rasmussen. That's music from the violin concerto of my guest, Sunleif Rasmussen. Beautiful, beautiful writing.
Thank you.
Now, I have to push forward to ask you a little bit more about some other composers that are present at this Other Minds Festival. There's several other Scandinavians that are a part of this crew.
There is one composer from Sweden, yeah. Mm-hmm. And the thing that's so beautiful, I think, about this festival is that all composers are totally different. And we have been together on Jurassi for 3 days or something like that, discussing our music.
I should mention that the Jurassi experience is an important part of this Other Minds Festival, where you're just in the room rather than communicating by internet or by Pony Express. You're actually creating over a course of several days with these folks from different disciplines.
And the musicians have also presented themselves and their instruments.
Yeah, and you're not only together in a room, you're together without any distraction from the outside, because you are very far away from other things. You are forced to listen to each other. That's really
and
wonderful.
And it's so beautiful in nature. I mean, and the weather was astonishing. No wind, sun from morning to evening. And I think it's very good to start a festival like that, because you're forced to, even you have some aesthetics disagreement or something, you're forced to talk together and to listen to each other. That's what music is about, to listen to each other and to try to come into each other's way of thinking. And that has been a great experience for me on this festival. I think it's very, very, very good. And also to have the musicians there to present their way of thinking.
Yes.
Which is very similar, as Mikola mentions, very similar to our way of thinking music, because we like to interact with musicians the whole time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we all have a goal to reach other people's minds, I think. We do it in each our way, both the creative and the recreative.
And how appropriate that this is called Other Minds.
Other people's minds.
Yeah, other minds. The Other Minds Festival gets underway tonight at the Jewish Community Center on California Street in San Francisco. Full details about the festival is at otherminds.org. Mikola Petri, recorder virtuoso, I wish you the very best. And we're going to end with a little bit more music from Sunleif Rasmussen, something from his award-winning Symphony No. 1, Oceanic Days. Have a wonderful festival, and I look forward to hearing the concerts.
Thank you very much.
music of Sunleif Rasmussen, one of the composers represented at the Other Minds Festival 18, underway starting this evening. Information at otherminds.org. I'm pleased to welcome to the KLW studios Nolan Gasser and Carrie Harrison, collaborators on a new opera which has been commissioned by San Francisco Opera and is a co-production with Cal Performances. It's based on the beloved 1911 book by Frances Hodgson Burnett, The Secret Garden, and will be presented the weekends of March 1st and 9th at Zellerbach Hall in Berkeley. Nolan Gasser, composer for this opera, is a critically acclaimed composer, pianist, and musicologist, most notably the architect of Pandora Radio's Music Genome Project, the subject of another visit here soon, I hope. His original works have been performed in such prestigious venues as Carnegie Hall and the Kennedy Center, where his Cosmic Reflection, a narrated symphony, the second commission associated with NASA's Fermi mission, depicting the entire history of the universe, and also a collaboration with Mr. Harrison, received its world premiere there. In addition to that, he's working on a musical, Benny and June, in partnership with H2H Productions and MGM On Stage, and a book on the interrelation of music and science. Nolan Gasser, welcome to KLW.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Burnett's book, The Secret Garden, has been adapted to libretto by Carrie Harrison, an English novelist and dramatist. Harrison was born in London to actors Rex Harrison and Lily Palmer and raised in Los Angeles and New York. He's the author of 40 stage plays and 16 novels, and among his many accolades are a Sony Radio Academy Award, the Giles Cooper Award, the UK Writers Guild Award for Best Play, as well as two nominations for the Pushcart Prize for Journalism. We managed to catch Carrie during rehearsals here prior to his return home to New York, where he is professor of English at Brooklyn College of the City University of New York, my former alma mater and place of employ, and artistic director of the Woodstock Players Theater Company. Carrie, a great pleasure to welcome you.
Thank you so much.
Now, Carrie, as a Brit, I'm supposing you are probably more familiar than most with the book The Secret Garden than folks on this side of the pond, even though you were raised here in the States.
That's true. I do find that people know and love the book over here, perhaps even better than they do in Britain. It's very well known and loved here. Wherever I go and mention the subject of our opera, it seems to cause great excitement, which is wonderful for us.
For those unfamiliar with the story, could you maybe offer us a brief synopsis?
It concerns a child, Mary Lennox, who is born in India to British colonial military parents. They are killed, they die in an outbreak of cholera. She's left an orphan. She's sent home to Britain to an uncle she's never met, to a lonely, huge house on the Yorkshire moors, the most gothic environment you could imagine. And she's already a solitary and sullen and unloved child. So she arrives with quite a journey to go to become a happier child. And the house where she finds herself has a secret, has another child of her age, hidden away, whom she only hears through a crying noise, and who she finally discovers and enables to be liberated as she is. It's an extraordinary story, double story of overcoming solitude and discovering that nature itself is the healer. And hence The Secret Garden, and this derives from Burnett's, the author's, passionate belief in the healing powers of nature, and that's really what the story is about.
Well, some of that plot sounds more Edward Gorey and Tim Burton than Nolan Gasser.
Oh, there's
and
a real
Gary
element
Harrison.
Of that.
Well, where do you think they got it from?
Nolan, perhaps you could share with us how you first collaborated with Carrie Harrison and how that relationship began.
Well, sure. Well, with Carrie, as you actually noted in your intro, Carrie and I met with regard to another composition of a very different nature. I was commissioned by folks associated with NASA and also at Stanford to write, actually as a second work for full orchestra and narrator, a piece that would depict the entire history of the universe, obviously a bit audacious, but in 40 minutes. So it doesn't take 13.8 billion years to have the piece. This was a collaboration with a number of folks. And to make a long story short, Carrie was brought in to be the narrator, as you can tell already, with his wonderful
nice chops
baritone
there,
chops, yes. And, you know, there was an instant connection between the two of us. And so we began toying with the notion of how great it might be to collaborate on an opera right at the same time that I was beginning conversations with David Gockley of San Francisco Opera. And so the stars just fully aligned with these meetings and conversations. And initially, David and I talked about the prospect of writing something for the big stage, a war memorial. Certainly, that was my sort of hope initially. But given the great number of commissions he had already on the books, he inquired whether I would be interested in writing a family opera. And so I immediately thought, well, why not? You know, it's a great, especially for a first-time opera composer, to have something a little less, you know, sort of demanding. And Carrie and I both thought, what a great way of you know, being able to expand the audience. And so we began toying with various subjects, and not surprisingly, Secret Garden made its way to the top very quickly.
Well, I think many people will think of the 1991 Broadway musical when they think of a theatrical version of the story, The Secret Garden. But that really wasn't the first theatrical or film version of The Secret Garden. In fact, in 1919, there was a film version, but that film is thought lost. In 1949, MGM filmed it, kind of giving a second adaptation with Margaret O'Brien, Dean Stockwell, Brian Roper as the principal characters. And it's kind of a nod to The Wizard of Oz. They filmed it in black and white, but they filmed the garden sequences in color. And then, of course, the 1991 Broadway version. So bringing it to an operatic version, how did that influence you?
Well, I mean, it's true that we were well aware of the adaptation for the stage. And in fact, when we first presented our list to David, I was actually concerned that he might find Secret Garden not so compelling because it had already been, you know, sort of made into a stage production. Happily, that made sort of no difference to him. And I was aware of the musical, certainly, and all of its credits. And I knew several of the songs. I actually didn't know specifically how it had adapted the story. But as it turns out, as I've come to learn, they take such a varied approach, sort of an alternate approach to the whole story. They really shift the emphasis in many ways from these children to the adults. And they even sort of, you know, fabricate a character, the brother of Archibald Craven, Mary's uncle, who becomes a key figure in their sort of competitive love for Lilius, who is the mother of Colin, who, of course, dies 10 years ago, which is part of the main thrust of the story. And so Carrie and I think always had the notion that we would write the story based on Hodgson Burnett. Mm-hmm. And so in many ways, yes, Secret Garden has been adapted, but in some ways, no, it hasn't.
Sure.
Because it really is such
the musical take. Did us a huge favor by not adapting the book faithfully.
Ah, interesting. I was going to ask you.
And left us to try and do that to the best of our ability.
And there still must have been a daunting amount of winnowing to do from the book and to get what would have to be, I imagine, a 45 to an hour long production. This is coming.
Well, it's the entire production with intermission is 2 hours.
2 hours.
So it's an hour and 40 minutes of music. So it's a prologue and two acts. So prologue and first act is like the first half, and that's about 45, and the second half is about 55 or so.
But that is a winnowing. You're absolutely right. It's a very long book.
Could you maybe address? Did you just say, oh, obviously we're not going to do this or that or this whole section or this whole aspect of their lives, or did you want to just get the plum sections that would adapt well to the stage?
I think the reason the book is long, or as long as it is because of the time the author allows herself in which to follow the evolution of these children from loneliness to joy. And it's lovely to have every page of it. And I think it's one of the reasons that children and adults continue to enjoy it. But all that was required, and in some ways, when I say all, it wasn't that easy, was to deal with the foreshortening that we had to make of the whole adventure. We didn't really have to cut out any major episodes or characters. And here, I think, doing it as an opera seemed to offer the compensation of what music could say in such a short space that a theater adaptation, a drama or a film adaptation would struggle to do. You could leap to the heart of the emotion of each stage of their story And that was, I think, the key for us.
Mm-hmm. Nolan, could you talk a little bit about setting those words to music? Is there some that is spoken like a recitative versus every note being sung according to the libretto?
Right. Well, it is. I mean, it is an opera, so it is almost entirely sung. There are a few moments of actually spoken text, really for sort of dramatic effect. You know, Carrie did a brilliant job of adapting, not only in this process of winnowing, which obviously we both sort of talked about continuously, and really up until the very the very last stages of what could we sort of excise.
Well, I suppose as the son of Rex Harrison, you've grown accustomed to his pace.
Ba-dum-bum.
I didn't see that one coming.
That's right. He's been working on that one for a while, I'm sure. But it's interesting, that Carrie in his description of the overall story used the expression that Mother Nature is the healer, which is one of the beautiful lines. I don't know if it's actually, I've lost track whether it's Harrison or Hodgson Burnett. I think they've sort of merged in some ways, but that actually is a line from the finale. What Carrie has been able to do is to really embody and embrace this full, because it's not just the story, it's also the overriding philosophy. In terms of the musical setting, unlike a play where you obviously have lots of dialogue and conversation to make the story move forward, in opera, too much dialogue and you're going to run into trouble. Mm-hmm. So really, it's the arias that really tell the real crux of the story, that tell the sort of the emotional progression, that sort of capture some of the magic, both of the garden and, you know, the moor, or the emotion that Craven has for his long-lost wife, and so forth. You know, obviously there does need to be some dialogue, which is said in a more recitative style, without a doubt. And but as Carrie says, there's a fair amount of purely instrumental music, both for, you know, sort of necessary theatrical reasons to, you know, transition from one scene to the other, but also to help propel this story, because indeed we have a 350-page book that we need to make work in an hour and 40 minutes.
Well, talk a little bit about your orchestration. What are you using in the orchestra?
Well, when David, you know, decided for a family opera, part of his rationale was to do, you know, not spend too much money. We obviously, it was geared towards family. So I, you know, not just kids, but kids and their parents and grandparents. And I think that it was certainly very important to me, I know to Carrie as well, that we hit both, you know, or we hit all generations in terms of what the content is. So David had put certain limitations on the number of singers and the number of musicians, you know, partly to make it sort of that kind of accessible and kind of production. So we have 8 singers and we have 10 instrumentalists.
Nice. So it's a chamber orchestra.
It's a chamber opera. And so if my initial reaction was, oh, man, I don't have my string section. I don't have, you know, my 4 horns. But once I got over that, I sort of began to realize the power of this, you know, chamber, obviously this wonderful cohesive quality that a chamber orchestra can get, even more than an orchestra can potentially get.
Are you incorporating synthesizer though?
I decided that I really wanted it to be in a purely acoustic. There is, so the instrumentation, for those keeping track.
Your pencils out.
Yeah, that's right. Flute doubling piccolo, oboe doubling English horn, French horn, trumpet, piano, percussion, and one of each of the string sections. So one violin, one viola, one cello, and one double bass. So I kind of got the orchestra covered, just done, obviously, in a very...
And it's ready for the road. It's ready for the road show.
It's ready for whoever will has a big enough stage to put it on, which is also, and I'm sure we'll talk about, the sort of visual aspect.
Please.
Well, again, part of this, you know, the notion, you know, it's not just a matter of cutting corners, you know, obviously just making this economical. We actually don't have a turntable, as is traditionally found in an operatic production, but we have something quite brilliant. And we have this wonderful visual designer, artist, who works in multiple media, painting, photography, video, Naomi Kramer, and who spends half of her time in Berkeley and half of her time in Paris. Must be nice. She has just created these, you know, as Carrie, maybe you can talk about your impressions as well. It's almost sort of surrealistic sense of whether it's the garden or the trip across the ocean or the manor house itself, projected onto 4 scrims. And so what the advantage of that is, when Mary is having to go chase this sound that she doesn't know what it is or where it's coming from, and she travels through the house, which Hodgson Burnett can describe with all the details of the rooms and the doors, what we can do is actually have, you know, Mary walking down a hallway, and the hallway is actually moving with her.
Oh, neat. Because
it's actually video with these, you know, old Gothic photos.
Also certainly saves money in the props department, right?
That's right.
It does. It's beautiful. As Nolan says, the beauty of it is that it can be as realistic as you want when it wants to be, when it needs to be, or is convenient. And it can be quite surrealistic at times, that brings the characters, the singers, the actors forwards, because there isn't a match between the background and them in terms of traditional imagery or just in terms of a realistic background to figures. But it's enormously suggestive, impressionistic, extraordinarily beautiful. And so it evokes what you want to support the scenes and the characters. And because she's a masterly artist, I think it's something that people are going to enjoy hugely.
Well, let's hear a little bit of the music, and we will then come back and talk a little bit more about The Secret Garden, an opera by Nolan Gasser and Carrie Harrison. Perhaps you could set up this clip. This is Robin, Robin.
Right. Well, this, of course, this particular performance is just piano and voice. It's actually being sung by San Francisco Adler Laura Crum, and this is an aria sung in the opera by Mary. But Laura is actually singing the role of Martha, who is the happy Yorkshire housemaid, sort of friendly spirit that Mary encounters. But in this track, she is playing the role of Mary. So Robin is Act One, Scene Two, so pretty early in the opera. And so after first encountering Mary, and obviously after the whole scene in India, Martha tells Mary to go play in the garden to kind of, you know, get in touch with nature. And so shortly after arriving, she sees this robin flying around this very wall. You know, obviously it's a walled garden, this very high wall. And then she encounters Ben the gardener, who's kind of a grumpy old character, and she wants to know about the secret garden, and Ben won't have anything to do with her or telling that story. And then the robin comes back, and Ben says, go ahead and talk to the robin. And so that's what this is, a conversation between Mary and Robin, Mary's hoping that maybe the robin will become her first friend.
Music of Nolan Gasser, and a libretto adapted by Carrie Harrison, Robin, Robin, while hearing Laura Crum singing.
Thank you.
Adler fellow Laura Crum singing a piano accompaniment of Robin Robin from the Nolan Gasser Carrie Harrison opera The Secret Garden. Soprano Sarah Schaefer will be performing the songs with Chamber Orchestra in the productions, which will be March 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, and 9th, and 10th, coming here to Zellerbach Hall in Berkeley. Nolan Gasser and Carrie Harrison, my guests here on Open Air. Gentlemen, I think we're going to conclude with another clip, and I'd like to thank you, first of all, for spending some time to tell us about this wonderful collaboration process. I know it's a long process, and there are aches and pains associated with any kind of birth, and I wish you the best on this project.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
My guests, Nolan Gasser, Carrie Harrison, thank you once again for coming into KLW.
Thank you very much, David.
It's been a great pleasure.
Yes.
The Secret Garden will be sung in English with English supertitles at Zellerbach Hall this and next weekend. For full information, visit calperformances.org. David LaTulipe concluding Open Air this week with friend Peter Robinson, who's here to tell us what to expect post-Downton from the folks at HBO. Good afternoon, Peter.
Hi, David. Good to be here. And I'm smiling just listening to The Secret Garden when they say English with English subtitles. And I'm saying to myself, yeah, why can't the English teach their children how to speak?
Or how to sing, for that matter.
How to sing, yeah, because that was Carrie Harrison, and that is, of course, the son of Rex Harrison. So there we have it. But we move from secret gardens to the trenches of the First World War. And this is a BBC series. It was released in September, and that's when I first saw it. I happened to be in the UK then.
It's called Parade's End.
It's called Parade's End, and it's based on a quartet, four novels by Ford Madox Ford. This is not Downton Abbey, so I want to get that out of the way to start with.
And you're not repeating yourself. It is Ford Madox Ford.
This is Ford Madox Ford, and that is not an auto dealer in downtown San Francisco. That is a distinguished turn-of-the-century, early 20th century British author. And just before I explain a little bit about Ford Madox Ford and his writing, let me make this distinction between Parade's End and Downton Abbey. It is set in the same period. It's the Edwardian period. It's the twilight of a disappearing empire. And it is a class story. The officer class is the actual phrase that Ford Madox Ford uses in describing the actual characters and the women who are of that class. Now, the difference between the novel, Parade's End, and the television series, which HBO are screening starting this Sunday, is that Tom Stoppard has done the script.
Not a shabby writer himself.
No, that's right. And I think this is particularly significant, I think, for three reasons. Ford Madox Ford grew up in England, but his family were German. He had a sort of dilemma when the First World War broke out, not so much being a dual national, but wondering why couldn't people speak to each other? How come these two ancient civilizations, the British and the Germanic civilization, had come to blows, so to speak? And I think that's a dilemma expressed frequently in the mind of the key character, Christopher Tichens. Tichens is, in fact, a Czechoslovakian origin name, although he's British in the, as the story reveals. But back to Tom Stoppard. If we remember a couple of Tom Stoppard's early plays, such as Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, these are stories of the wrong people being in the wrong place at the wrong time. No Prince Hamlet, just mere attendant lords. And they get sucked up into the whole drama of Hamlet himself. Tom Stoppard's other, I think, great gift is his wit. He condenses things down, can say things quickly. And we're looking at a book which is written over 4 years, from roughly about 1924 to 1929, when a more Victorian, certainly an Edwardian style of writing, heavy in adjectives, made the story what some people may call progressively slow. So unlike Julian Fellowes, who's writing about the aristocracy upstairs, downstairs in the 21st century, looking back, writing for television, fast, chatty dialogue, here we have a book, Parade's End, which was written very close to the time that the First World War had finished in 1919. Ford Madox Ford is an interesting person in the sense that he was suffering from amnesia in the early 1920s. And I think in this book, if you check out the number of times the word mind is used, and the fact that many people and many crits have seen it as a difficult story to follow, you will see that he was able somehow to convey that feeling of amnesia, forgetfulness, what happened. And it's not unlike post-traumatic stress disorder that we see today with people coming back both from Iraq and Afghanistan. It is a great cast, Rupert Everett, Jane McTree, Stephen Graham and Miranda Richardson. So the BBC have paraded out some of the great names from theatre. It is going to go slowly, so don't expect people racing through doors with guns shooting, but there is shooting in the background. And I think, too, you get that sense of the trenches. The two middle books were based on them. So people familiar with that literature, Robert Graves, Goodbye to All That, the poetry of Wilfred Owen, and even to some extent T.S. Eliot in The Wasteland, these are all background books that were written at the same time that Parade's End is airing.
Great wealth of material to draw from, that's for sure.
Yeah, so I recommend it. It's something different. It is on HBO this weekend. The subject, the Edwardian classes, the change in a disappearing empire, Parade's End by Ford Madox Ford, script by Tom Stoppard, airing on HBO starting this Sunday evening.
Well, Peter, thanks for sharing that. I'll look forward to that as well as catching up with the DVRs of Downton's Abbey, which I haven't seen any of this season yet.
Well, one thing at a time.
Thanks again for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks again to producer Niels Swinkels and Great Dane Annette Bistrup for the Faroe Islands History Lesson. I'm David Latulippe. You've been listening to Open Air. Thanks again for listening.